Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about estate planning for families. However, we could take a tangent and talk about estate planning, not for families. But anyway, to lead us in that discussion is Mark Levine, partner.
Sure.
Handler and Levine, Bethesda, Maryland. But certainly can take calls from anywhere else. And you can call us at 202-465-3080. And we'll get to Mark's focus points as to calling him or emailing him in a little bit. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. And John Elliott, federal benefit strategist, retired. Soon to retire from the seminar circuit.
I've already done that.
Oh, break my heart. All right. So
my last one got canceled, so due to budget, so I'm done.
Okay. But John still does emails, and he does the show, and he knows federal benefits.
I say he still knows everything. He just doesn't talk about it as much anymore.
Good to see you, John.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay. Estate planning for families. Where do we start here? I'm coming in to see you, Mark, and let's say I have a family, and what do I do, Mark?
I think, one of the first times people really start to focus on estate planning is when they are pregnant or they have a child or they have a couple of kids and they haven't dealt with it. And so for a lot of people, that's really the first time they ever think about estate planning at all is, I've got these kids, I have a responsibility, what do I do next? And so I think coming in to talk to the attorney, very much like you just said, what do? We have nothing, we know we need something, we have no idea what it is that we need, what do we do next? And I think that, when you're talking about estate planning for families, very often it's not focused as much on estate taxes or on money or even on probate issues as it is on the children. And there's a very real focus on, okay, I'm here because if something happens to me, if something happens to my husband or my wife, how are my kids taken care of? And so the first thing I think that a lot of people think about is who's the guardian, who's going to be in charge of the money, things like that for the kids. And I will tell you that I think it's the number one reason why people in that situation don't do estate planning is they can't agree on who the guardian's going to be. I hate your brother. You hate my sister. We both like our brother and sister, but we hate the people they're married to. Who's going to take care of our kids? And so rather than work through that, very often it's just sort of, well, we won't do anything and we'll hope for the best. And that usually works out, statistics tell us. But in the cases where it doesn't, it's sort of disastrous.
Could I ask you a question? And I think the answer is not easy. When would be the earliest time somebody should come to see you in this situation, or the latest time? Well, there is no latest time, but when does it get, why weren't you here before?
I wouldn't say often, but it's not unusual for me to be among the first people to know someone's pregnant. In other words, they will come in very early in the pregnancy to start doing their planning. And it's easier sometimes to tell a stranger than it is to tell family, and it's easier to do that. And the people who are very organized, they do it very early on. And so they may only be a couple months pregnant and they're coming in to start looking and doing the work, which is obviously the best. We've had a couple of situations where people have missed meetings to come in and sign documents because they were on the way to the hospital. So they waited sort of too late to the end there. But we got everything done afterwards. We've never had a big problem with it. Obviously, after someone dies, it's too late. And you've missed a lot of the opportunities to do the kind of planning that you want to do. So you're right. There's never really a too late as long as you can still do it. A week before you're going to go in the hospital, we can get the process started, but chances are there's not going to be anything set up before the baby comes. So as early in the process as possible is the best thing to do. And I've had people come in just when they're starting to plan for a family and say, well, we know we're going to have kids. We know, and this is part of the process. We're going to get our life insurance in place. We're going to get our estate planning in place. And that's the best scenario.
All righty. When you teach the seminars, the NITP, which is the company that provides this show, but when you teach, do you ever get people coming up that didn't come as early as we just mentioned, and maybe they're midway through, maybe they're three quarters of the way through, and they go, should I be coming to you? Do you get those kind of questions?
Sure, all the time. And there's never a time that's too late. Anytime someone comes in, you know, one of the things that we like to do is make sure there's a healthcare directive in place for the woman, especially, obviously, because pregnancy, while not dangerous necessarily, is you're going to the hospital and you want to make sure that the things are spelled out that you want to happen. So very often in those cases where it's like, well, we have a scheduled event a week from now for this baby to come, what can we do? We can start the process, we can get the information, and we can get a healthcare directive in place, perhaps a temporary guardianship in place if it's not a married couple and there may be some concerns about the father's rights to make decisions and things like that.
Okay, now I know we're talking about estate planning for families, but you bring up the term healthcare directive. Anybody should be concerned about this.
From the day they turn 18 to the day they die, okay, everybody needs a healthcare
family
directive.
Family, no family, single, married, whatever. Okay,
that's right.
I just veered off of that so that those listening that are in that category said, I don't have one of those.
That's right.
Should I? All right, let's get back to, though, the focus. So we have the healthcare directive at a minimum, but then beyond that, I mean, estate planning to some folks sounds like that's just for somebody with all kinds of assets and they don't know what to do with them, or they do know what to do with them but need a little guidance. Estate planning isn't necessarily just that, right?
That's right. I mean, a lot of people think of estate planning as something they don't need to do. They just need a will. They don't need to do estate planning. And really, estate planning is about making sure that everything's pointed in the right direction. And often for people who are younger, starting families, they don't have as much in the bank and they may not have as much sort of hard assets. But what they often have a lot of is life insurance. And they sometimes will have a lot in a retirement account. And they will have things that are beneficiary designated. And a beneficiary designation is a contract between you and your employer or an insurance company or someone that says, at my death, give this money to this person. And so a lot of their assets are often tied up in life insurance, for example. And what you have to understand is that to make that work the way you want, the designation has to work in conjunction with your will. So, for example, if a beneficiary designation for your life insurance says to my husband, but if my husband predeceases me, to my children, well, your children get that money when they turn 18. And it's very hard to use for them before they turn 18, although it's possible. You have to go to the court and deal with courts in that. But if you have a trust in your will for your kids, that trust can't go and get the money and pull it into the will, into the trust. You have to make the trust the beneficiary. So the beneficiary for the life insurance really should say to my husband, but if my husband predeceases me, to the trust I created in my will at Article 7th or something like that, something specific to the trust you've created, so that the money will go into the trust for the benefit of the kids. And that's kind of the best example of estate planning. Estate planning is making sure everything's pointed in the right direction, that all the same people have the power that you want, all the money's going where you want it to go from all these disparate sources.
Could I drill into that a little bit more?
Sure.
You used the term trust. To me, until not that many years ago, trust was always, that's something. But a trust is, excuse the simplicity here, is nothing more than a movement of assets over here inside of this thing called a trust rather than into our bank account that we're going to take care of anyway.
So you think of a trust as a bucket. I mean, basically, okay, you're going to create this bucket for money to go into. And that bucket has a set of instructions as to how things can be taken out of it. How can this money that we've put into this trust, this bucket, be used in the future? And so at your death, you're going to say, take these assets and put them into this trust. Now, the trust is going to have a bank account, and it's going to have a brokerage account, and it's going to have a person, the trustee, who's in charge of managing all of that. That's the person whose job it is to hire an investment advisor and hire an accountant and hire, if necessary, an attorney to advise them as to how to best use those assets.
Okay, I don't mean to be argumentative here, but if I didn't know any better, I might say, what do I need a trust for? I just need a bank account.
Because a bank account, if the money just goes into the bank account, so, you know, you're gone, your spouse is gone, there's a guardian set up by the court to control the money, and at 18, your child has the right to take that money and do anything they want with it. Most 18-year-olds make spectacularly bad decisions with money. They either will spend it on things that are not good for them, they'll spend it on things that aren't going to last, or out of the goodness of their heart, they'll spend the money on their friends that need help or other people that need help, and they won't have it for themselves when they need it. $100,000 to an 18-year-old seems like all the money you're ever going to need. $1 million life insurance policy going to an 18-year-old seems like definitely all the money you're ever going to need. And what we want is something that says, I want the money used for my child. Use it for their health, use it for their education, use it for their support. But I want someone else deciding what those things are. And I want them to write the check to the school, and I want them to write the check for rent, and I want them to buy a Honda instead of a Ferrari when they need a car. And so the trustee is that person. You're setting up a person to make those decisions for your children, because when you're creating the trust, we're assuming you don't know them well enough to think they can do it for themselves. I love my kids. They seem like great kids, but they're 6, 9, and 11 and a half. I have no idea who they're going to be. So I've set up a trust in my will that goes till they're 40. And I hope when they're 20, I'm going to look at that and say, well, that's ridiculous. These kids are great kids. I think they're going to handle the money. They seem like they're coming out okay. I'm going to make that trust 30. And at 25, I may look at them and say, well, that's ridiculous. These are good kids. They can handle the money better at 25 than I could have. I'm not going to have a trust at all for my kids. It is just going to go in their bank account. But that's a decision I want to make when they're 25, not when they're 11. At 11, I'd rather they get the money 5 years too late than 5 years too early. I'd rather they have to get up every day and go to work and have a job and do all those things.
Could I veer off a little to financial planning?
Sure.
All right. You mentioned life insurance and probably the need for just flat out the cheapest life insurance you can get, because resources are sometimes slim when families start. Is life insurance, should the major income earner leave us? And sometimes, not sometimes, that generally is a lot of money, because it has to care, feed, and educate these youngsters for an awful long time. Now, would that also be another reason to have it in a trust, such that if it went into an estate, it could wind up being subject to income tax, or maybe not at the federal level, but potentially at the state level, should the other one go? And if it gets over into a trust, correct me if I'm wrong, it just kind of falls outside of that estate that an individual would have. Am I right with that?
Yeah, I think that for a lot of people in my situation, a lot of people with young kids, the reason they have an estate tax issue is because of life insurance. If I didn't have life insurance, I wouldn't have an estate tax issue. But I live in Maryland. There's $1 million exemption in Maryland. My wife and I together clearly have more than $1 million of life insurance when we're both gone. So that means there'd be a taxable estate when both of us die. By having the life insurance owned by what's called an irrevocable life insurance trust, that life insurance isn't included in our estate for estate tax purposes. So when life insurance causes the estate tax problem, looking at an irrevocable life insurance trust is a great option, because you can completely eliminate sometimes the entire problem by using life insurance.
Okay, I'm sorry to divert over there, but just thought I'd want to make the point.
No, it's a good point.
Let's get back then to the trust. You mentioned that right now yours includes somebody of 40. I, unfortunately, was once a trustee of something like that, but for the other reason, the person had to be under control. I was sued 4 times. Finally, I said, you know, every time you sue me, you're paying the legal fees. It stopped it. Not that I was doing anything wrong, it's just that the person felt that I should be doing other things with the money, but I knew it had to last for till at least 40, and so I was, you know, I was fairly chintzy with what went out. But if there was medical needs, done. If there was other needs, done. But, you know, credit card bills, you know, I can't pay them.
Right.
You're the one that signed it, not me. I wasn't quite. And then actually, it turned out very good. I almost became like a surrogate father. And the beginning was rough.
I think that, you know, again, when you're talking about little kids, there's no question you're going to set up a trust. And a lot of times when you're deciding, am I going to do a trust at all? It's this tension between control and efficiency. And the more control you want, the less efficient it is. So in your situation, there wasn't a lot of efficiency clearly at the beginning, because they didn't like the fact that you were in control. And so they used up resources from the trust to try and fight that. Not very efficient at all, but the control was there. As my kids get older, I hope that I see that balance differently, that I'm more concerned about efficiency than control, and I'm going to scale back the trust. But I think your situation that you talk about brings up two important points, really. One is, do we have to make it so the trust must last till 40? And two, who are we picking as the trustee? And so the first part of that, when you're creating the steps of the trust, when does the money go out? We always like flexibility. So my trust for my kid says, you know, they get something at 22, 25, 30, 35, and 40. It also says to my trustee, help them buy an appropriate house if they're doing what they should be doing. Help them start an appropriate business. Pay for a wedding. I have three girls, so pay for one wedding for each of them. And if they have kids of their own, help them with their kids. But it also says that if my sister, who happens to be my trustee, thinks that my kids can handle it, so my 11-year-old is a hedge fund manager at 27, my sister has the power to give her everything at 27. But if one of my kids is making skeevy boyfriend choices at 33, she's not going to get the money till she's 40. And there's language that says if there's drugs or alcohol, if there's spousal issues, if there are other issues that would make a distribution harmful, then my trustee can hold it longer. And so I'm giving my sister all that flexibility. As my kids get older, I hope to switch that. I hope to say, well, I know my kids better now. I'm not concerned about some of these things, and I'm going to change that around. So we want to be able to let the money get out early. We want to be able to hold the money longer depending on the situation when you're dealing with little kids. The second part of that, picking the trustee, also kind of depends on when you're picking them. So when they're minor kids, it's important to think about who the guardian is in conjunction with who the trustee is. The vast majority of people are going to name their guardian as their trustee because they find it hard to say to that person, look, I trust you with my kids. I just don't trust you with their money. And that's maybe true, but it's hard to say. And so I usually counsel people to include the guardian at least as a co-trustee. And the reason is I want my sister, for example, to be a guidepost to my kids, to raise them. I like her decision-making and her morals, and I want her to have an impact on them if I'm gone. If at 18 she suddenly is no longer involved with the money and she's no longer has the legal right to tell them what to do, then they're going to listen to the person with the money. They're not going to listen to my sister anymore. And so I want that guardian who's taking care of my kids to be involved in the financial aspect of things as well. Obviously, as the kids get older, that's less important. And certainly adult kids, it's less important. So then you look at what's their relationship with the kids? Are they going to know what's going on? Are they going to be able to say no? Is it a good idea to name the older sister as the trustee for the younger sister? Well, usually not, because you're going to end up in a situation where the older sister has to decide, do I want to be her sister or do I want to be her trustee? If I'm her sister, I got to give her the money because otherwise she won't forgive me. If I'm her trustee, she's going to stop wanting to be my sister. And so that's where you may look at other people as trustees. The most important qualifications for a trustee, trust, obviously. If you don't trust the person, don't pick them. And the second is common sense. You know, they don't have to know how to file a estate tax return or an income tax return or do any of the legal or financial investing issues. They need to know how to hire good people who know how to do those things. They need to be able to manage people. And so you look for people you trust with common sense, and if you have a situation that really requires it, then you look at professionals. You look at attorneys or accountants, banks or trust companies, but those people are always going to charge. And you know, you have to decide, is that fitting with what we're doing right now?
Do you find in your practice when people come in and address this trustee issue, naturally, I would think people would be adverse to picking a professional that they'd have to pay X dollars per hour. But do you ever challenge them to say, well, I want my best friend, Sam or Sally, to do this? And then you go, well, now what attributes do Sam and Sally have? And then you have to be very diplomatic to say, you know, they might be great people, but they have to say no potentially to younger people. And so they have to have some spine. That's tightrope.
You know, the nice thing for me is in the vast majority of cases, I don't know Sally or their friends, whoever they are. And so I can just play devil's advocate. I can say, listen, I'm sure none of this applies to your friend, but what about this scenario? What about that scenario? What about this? Here are things that have happened over the course of my practice that I've had to deal with in these similar situations. So, you know, what happens if, yes, yeah, Sally's great, but she gets hit by a truck. Now, what are we talking about? And who's the backup person? And a lot of times we're working co-trustees into those situations. And sometimes they want a professional co-trustee to help Sally say no. You know, Sally can say, well, I would do it for you, of course. But Attorney Levine is a pain and he keeps saying no. And so, sorry, we can't do it. And so the professional kind of becomes the punching bag sometimes in those situations.
Actually, I use that a fair amount. I said, blame it on me. Yeah. You know, an accountant is easy to blame things on because they're not looked at as the most flexible.
You know, imagine then about being able to blame attorneys. It's fairly easy, too.
You don't fool with them, though. Accountants are kind of punching bags. I don't think I'd want to punch an attorney. I don't think I'd want to punch anybody. But anyway, we got an email, and it was, and I don't know that it's just for this area. We just happen to be in a tri-state area, and the borders are not that far from one another, but it could be anybody that's close to another state. And the individual wrote, and I forget what they wrote, but I think you've got it.
He said, do Maryland law firms provide estate planning services, generally provide wills, advanced medical directives, and power of attorney documents for a single fee? That's the first part of his question. And the vast majority of estate planning is done on a flat fee basis. Most attorneys will have a free consultation and meet with you. And at the end, they'll tell you, you know, well, you're going to do X, Y, and Z and do it for a flat fee. Not always. Some attorneys still go by an hourly basis. And you want to be really crystal clear when you go in to talk to the attorney how it is that they're going to bill you. Another part of the question was, have there been changes to Maryland law in the last few years that warrant a legal review of such documents? Not shockingly, I'm going to say yes. I think that, you know, things change over a period of time. We always suggest to our clients to come back in every 3 years or so. We send out a letter saying come in for a checkup, and they almost always ignore it. But, you know, usually in that 5 to 6 year period, if you haven't had anything looked at in that period, I think it's a good idea to go and talk to somebody. Births, deaths, inheritance, win the lottery, those are all good reasons to go in and have your documents.
And if your kids get married? Would that be a trigger?
Yeah, if your kids get married, if you're going to have kids, if they're going to have kids, having grandkids changes the equation somewhat, because while you're perfectly happy for the money to go to your child, what if your child were to predecease you leaving a child? And then you're back to saying, well, I want their share to go into trust for their child. I don't want
not the widower.
Not usually. In other words, usually I don't want my son-in-law to get the money that would have gone to my daughter. I want my grandchildren to get the money that would have gone to my daughter. Now, my son-in-law, I may think is great, and I may want him to be the trustee. I may think he would use the money for his kids in their best interest. Absolutely.
Sure.
Sometimes I may not think that, but that's...
So you've got to look at major life events as a trigger to say, do I need to revisit my will?
Any kind of major life event is a good reason. And you know, as laws change, you know, when the estate tax laws change, it's usually big news. And if you think it might affect you, that's a good time.
But the average person not going to know about that, typically.
They'll usually hear about the federal tax, not so much the state taxes. And the state taxes are significant, and they can have a big impact on you.
Yeah, the listeners should dwell on that comment a little bit, because the estate tax, who knows what it's going to be after 2012, but it's pretty high right now. But state isn't necessarily, it's still high when you look at the numbers, but people don't always fully appreciate what's included in that number. And the Maryland estate tax is pretty high, isn't it? What's it, 16%?
It tops out at 16%. DC is actually a little bit higher, but they both have $1 million exemption. And what you have to figure is, if you're trying to figure out, do I have an estate tax issue, include everything that transfers to anyone else on account of your death. And if you think, well, maybe that isn't included, you're wrong. It's included. Jointly owned property, beneficiary designated property, probate property, all of that is almost always included in your estate. And so at $1 million exemption, it's not that hard to get to $1 million at the second death, certainly.
Okay, there are people going, are you kidding? But TSP can be part of that $1 million, no?
Your TSP counts, your life insurance counts, the equity in your house counts. Not only that, and although it usually doesn't become an issue, but the present day value of your retirement annuity counts. So the value of the CSRS annuity going to your surviving spouse actually counts in determining whether you have to file a return. Now, it also is deducted out going to a U.S. citizen. But if it's going to a non-U.S. citizen, it actually becomes a fairly significant asset and taxable.
And that's not real far from some of the agencies that we deal with where there are foreign spouses.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times these folks transfer overseas and don't always come back. Because they decide to move there.
Right. Absolutely.
And, you know, occasionally I'll get them and I say, oh, your problem isn't the tax question you asked. It's this. And I said, I don't know this. Anyway, let's get back to more the norm. So I think we answered our email or our questions. And again, for those listening, you can call us and should call us. It's 10:31. It's what is today? October 24th, 2011, and we'll be here till 10:58 and a half, right, Andrew? And then Andrew cuts us off. Not really. And don't call after that, but you can email us. We'll do the email later. But we're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And it's only fair now. How does one get in touch with you, Mark?
They can call me. My phone number is 301-961-6464, extension 3313. It's 301-961-6464, extension 3313. And my email is mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com. That's handlerlevine.com. So it's Mark with a C at handlerlevine.com.
You know, we have not seen your compatriot in a long time. I think he's afraid to come on because you'll call him up. I don't think he's afraid.
No, Norman's not afraid, but he did do that to me once. Yes,
yes, I remember it. All righty, let's come on back here. We talked about trust for the children, flexibility, guidelines, tension, potential, and efficiency. I like the word efficiency.
Well, I think what you have to remember, and again, I'd say the number one reason people in this situation don't come in is they don't have answers to the questions. And what you have to keep reminding yourself is don't let perfect get in the way of better. People all the time think, well, we have to have an answer and we don't know what the answer is, so we're not going to start the process. And if you don't make a decision will still be made. If something happens to you, someone will be put in charge of your kids and someone will be put in charge of their money, and it may or may not be the people you would want to be in charge. And so making a decision, even if we agree that 6 months from now we're going to revisit it or a year from now we're going to revisit it, is important because a decision will be made. There is a plan for what's going to happen to your stuff. There is a plan for what's going to happen to your kids. It's just that instead of you getting to decide what happens, the state decides what happens. And yeah, your family may come in and argue over who the best person is to be the guardian for this child, who the best person is to be in charge of the money for this child. And that's the last thing anybody wants in those situations.
Yeah, I had felt the need to change guardians while my kids were minors, from one of my siblings to the other, and not due to any family disputes or acrimony. But I came to the conclusion later that my sister was the better choice, both to act as a trustee as well as being the guardian. Yeah, it that's a tough decision. But of course, and you know, you don't have to tell the one you vacated necessarily, but you do have to tell the one that's the new trustee, and then
it's a good idea to tell the one you vacated.
Is it?
And well, because otherwise they when something happens, that's they're going to assert trying to assert control. I think what happens in a lot of situations is, you know, you have newborns, you have 1-year-olds, you have 2-year-olds, and you think, well, if something happens to me, my brother and sister who live in upstate New York are absolutely fine. They're going to go there. They'll adjust to their life. Everything will be great. And you look back at it 10 years later when they're 9 or 10 or 11, and you look at their life and how enmeshed they are with their life here or wherever you live, and you say, you know, if something happened to me, the last thing I want is in addition to losing me, they get ripped from everything they know. They get pushed and pulled somewhere else, and so that becomes a factor in what you're thinking. Now you're thinking, well, yes, my sister's the best person, but maybe she's no longer the best situation. You know, my brother is fine. My kids are older. They have a good sense of themselves. And I think it's more important now for them to stay here if something happened to me rather than go up to upstate New York or wherever your family happened to be. So those kinds of circumstances change where it has nothing to do with the two people involved. It has everything to do with your kids and their life and their situation that makes you want to change it. And then sometimes there are divorces and there are, you know, viewing how they raise their own kids and saying, I don't think I want my kid in that environment. I don't want them there. And those are obviously the harder conversations to have with the person you're vacating if you have that conversation at all.
Mark, do you ever get people that are, I won't say afraid, but anxious about coming to see you because they're coming to see you dealing with death.
Absolutely, all the time. My wife won't talk to me about this. She hates talking about it. You know, I made her sit down 11 years ago, and now she just basically, whenever I propose a change, she just says, I'm trusting you. You're my lawyer. I'm going to go with what you say. There are a lot of people who just don't want to deal with it, and I understand that. You know, the biggest compliment I get sometimes is when a client finishes the process or finishes a meeting and they say to me, well, that's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. I've been dreading this, but it wasn't as bad as I thought. And what you have to try and look at it as, honestly, a positive thing. You are planning proactively for something. And once it's done, it's done. You don't have to revisit it every day, every month. You have something in place and you can go on and think about other things. But yeah, a lot of people just don't want to deal with it. A lot of times I'll hear from clients, well, I'm trying to get my husband to focus on this. I'm trying to get my wife to focus on this. And they just can't. It's not something they want to focus on.
So actually, I think as professionals, the three of us here deal with the profession and the profession that we're not, a shrink. So we have to talk to people. John, I know, has done it in his career, in your career within the feds, and certainly when you're in front of a group, myself and now Mark, including family members.
Yeah, you know, I think what I also tell clients a lot, and I think this is true for any experienced estate planning attorney, is we've dealt with these situations before. We've had these conversations with clients before. If you can't get that last name down, come in, let's do everything else. Let's focus on what's left to do. And oftentimes, as part of the conversations, a lot of the mystery, a lot of the myth goes away, and you get a better idea of what does this person actually have to do, and what are their jobs, and how can we set it up to give them guidance? You know, one of the big things people are concerned about is, if our kids go to your sister, how will they ever interact with my family? And we have standard, paragraphs, and we have customized paragraphs, and we deal specifically with issues like that. How are we going to deal with vacations to see, the other side of the family, and keeping up contact with both the maternal and paternal sides of the family? And if there are religious issues, sort of outlining what you want to happen in that regard, and being very proactive about it and saying, yes, they could end up over here. And, your family's in Oregon and my family's in Florida. And how are they ever going to see their grandparents again if they're with your family? And dealing with that and knowing that there are ways to deal with it, I think, is something that we can offer when we sit down and talk to someone.
Okay. All right. Now, I see here that you have this great outline. Pet trust?
Well, pets or pets trust. There's a great book called All My Children Wear Fur Coats that talks about dealing with your pets. And I know immediately what people think about is Leona Helmsley. And they think, okay, I'm not leaving $7 million for my Chihuahua. That's ludicrous. And it is ludicrous. On the other hand, dealing responsibly with what happens to your pets is important. And so we do pet trusts a lot of times that are $20,000 or $25,000 that just say, listen, I want you to take care of this sometimes elderly pet. And I know there's a lot of expense that comes along with it. I just want to make sure I'm not giving you a debt, essentially, by doing this. I want to make sure you have some money to spend on their medical expenses and things like that. So while we don't deal with a lot of million-dollar pet trusts, we deal with a lot of $20,000 and $50,000. I had a client with a parrot, an African gray parrot. They've got a 80, 90-year life expectancy. And her concern was, she was 45 when she got it, it's going to outlive me. How do I make sure that the person I give it to has the money to take care of it? And so some of that is just being responsible. Who's going to take care of the pets, and do they have enough money to take care of the pets? And that's oftentimes intertwined with the kids, because if you have little kids, you often want the pets that they're accustomed to and attached to go with them. So just thinking about that.
As one age, as I have a pet trust, have to file a tax return for it. But the beneficiary is a charitable organization. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you'll say that you'll get a letter. Could I look at the numbers? Because this person, I would say, was smart. The kids were taken care of, and they inherited this money and was for this person's pets. But the residuals, should they not spend it, and it'd be pretty hard to spend this, it would go to this charitable organization. So it took a little bit of took a little bit of the bite away, but then every now and then you just feel somebody's on your shoulder saying, what'd you do?
Well, and the charitable organization is better than the kids. The vast majority of these pet trusts default to charitable organizations rather than to the family, because as bad as it is to have the charitable organization calling you, imagine having the three kids calling you saying, how's that pet doing? How much have you spent on that pet? What's left in that trust? You want that less than you want the charitable organization calling you every once in a while.
Very well put. Ever seen a pet trust for a snake?
No, I have not. Parrots, dogs, cats, llamas, but llamas? No snakes. Llamas. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but no snakes.
Just anyway, enough of that. I have a snake phobia. Anyway, then we got stuff, personal property, stuff. What do I do with the pinball machine? What do I do with Ann or Uncle, Ann Harriet or Uncle, whatever his name is, favorite dish that we inherited? Where does that go?
One of the things that causes the most problems in estate administration, whether it be through a trust or an estate, is things, stuff. Everyone's thrilled. If there are four kids and $100,000, they're all thrilled to get a $25,000 check. That's easy. If there's one dining room table, none of them want a leg. They all want the entire table, and none of them are going to be happy splitting it up or if just one of them gets it. And so the things that people argue about, and to a person almost, clients say to me, well, my kids won't argue because I don't have anything that's worth anything. So they won't care. They don't care. And what I tell them and what turns out to be true a lot of the times is it's not what it's worth. It's what it means. And it's not what it means right now. And it's not what it means 5 years after you're gone. It's what it means right after you die. And it's what it means when your sister gets it instead of you. And so all of those things come in. And I've had people argue for years over stuff and come back to me 5 years later and say, I don't know why we argued over it. That was ridiculous. But at the time, emotions are high. And the piano is the most important thing in the world. And the fact that the piano might go here instead of there becomes a scandal of epic proportions and something that they're willing to fight over. And so we strongly recommend people deal with that ahead of time. If you care where something goes, write it down. Say the piano goes here and the tools go there and this goes there. And everything else, just have a process to deal with.
But when you say write it down, do you mean include that in the will or trust?
Yes, I do. I mean include it in the will or trust.
As opposed to just a note.
That's right. That's right. Because you want to make sure that, if you care where it goes, you want the piano to go to John because John is the one who kept taking lessons. And all the rest of the kids, they frittered out and they didn't want to do it anymore and they wanted to go outside. But John kept on it and it's important to you that he gets the piano. You better write that down. John gets the piano. And just deal with those sorts of things that matter to you. I'm not suggesting a 30-page list of every item in your house be documented. I've gotten those lists, and they're no fun to deal with. But the things that you care about, you should write down.
It isn't undifferent than splitting up property in a divorce.
It's not, except that there's usually more people involved, and yeah, Someone just died, that was probably the person that kept you all from killing each other all those years anyway. So it's a lot of emotions, but it can be very similar.
Yeah. Yeah, I am a trustee of another, and I think it'll be just fine. I hope it's no time soon, but at a holiday, I remember one when these kids were young, and the one parent said, you're not going to get up from the table because Bob is your trustee and you want to keep him happy. That was a long time ago.
Well, I have a client who, and he's still alive, so I don't know what's going to happen, but his will says, my kids have 6 months to agree among themselves who gets what. And at the end of 6 months, everything gets sold and all the money goes to charity. So that's his way of saying to his kids, you have 6 months to act like adults. And if you can't act like adults during that 6 months, a pox on all your houses. None of you get any of it. So we'll see. He's still alive, so I don't know how that'll work out at the end.
We've seen that, I think, in high profile, like a sports team. There was one team that went to the spouse, and I'm not so sure the spouse knew anything more about football than they did rocket science. And then there was another one that it was a sports team. And the provision in the will said if any of the heirs bid on the sports team, they lose anything that they were entitled to in the will. So the will couldn't be, I guess, what do you call it, consummated until after the sale of the team.
Well, I mean, that's called an interim clause where you say, if you contest anything, it's a little different, but an interim clause basically says if you contest something, you don't get anything. And they have varying degrees of success. There's a lot of public policy exceptions to those kinds of clauses, because if there's a good reason to challenge something, the courts usually will let you do that.
Okay. I think we've kind of covered the trust. Tell me if we haven't. We talked about just recently tangible personal property, pets, funding, designated beneficiaries, guidelines for trust for kids, what a trust is.
Yeah, I think the other thing would be just, you know, we were focused sort of on minor kids, and the questions are easy for minor kids. It's do a trust and have people in charge of it and have lots of flexibility. And as the kids get older, you may have specific problems that you want to deal with. Trusts aren't just for minor kids. They're for adult children who can't handle money yet. And so as they get older, you're more aware of what their problems are and you're more specific about what the terms of the trust call for. It may not be any more generous to the kids or make it more available, but it's more specific.
Okay, I'm going to give you a TurboTax question for accountants to attorneys. All righty, so you can do trusts, wills, and whatnot on a computer. And I get the question, why should I use you instead of TurboTax? And you know, basically I said, well, you can't talk to TurboTax. You can ask me questions, although TurboTax is very good because it gives you prompts. But I'm going to throw the question at you on the legal side. Mm-hmm. What would be the plus for somebody to use that, or what would be the minus?
It's very much a question of efficiency versus effectiveness. So the will that you use is probably going to be effective. It's probably going to be valid on, you know, LegalZoom or whatever the programs are. The question is there somebody there talking to you about how your trustee gets along with your guardian, or how your trustee gets along with your kids, or how do the two guardians, you want your sister to be in charge, to be a guardian for your child, but does your brother-in-law, what's his role in all of this? And do you make both of them guardians? And if so, do you make both of them trustees, or you just make your blood relative a trustee, but both of them guardians? And talking about the particular people, which a program clearly can't do. They're not going to be able to ask you the questions and have a conversation with you about the people involved. And so these programs, I think, are very good at getting power to people, giving them authority. They're not going to be as good. They can't be as good at making sure that what happens next is tailored to your family, to your situation. It's going to be much more cookie cutter. Not that they don't have prompts, not that they don't ask you questions, but they are not capable, obviously, of having that discussion about the primary guardian and the backup guardian and co-guardians and the trustee, and also making sure that your other documents work with those documents. You know, your will is one document, but what happens when you become incompetent while you're alive? And so is your power of attorney going to work with a standby or temporary guardianship for your kids? And how does that get worked into who you ultimately want to be in control of the money and in control of the kids long term? And so making all of that work together and with the people that are appropriate for each role is always going to be better with a person than it is with a program. I've had clients call me and say, I'm heading overseas for a year in 2 days. Should I do this program? Well, yeah, that's better than nothing for sure. But is it really what the right answer is? It's not going to shock anyone to know that an attorney thinks, no, I can do a better job sitting down with people than a program can.
Right. And you probably get a lot of those calls. I'm going to get on a plane. I need a will in 6 hours. What are you doing for lunch?
My favorites are the cruises. I'm going on it. We leave for our cruise on Sunday. You know, it's Tuesday. Can we get something done? On the other hand, we get people, you know, having surgery. I just found out I need surgery on Monday and it's Tuesday. And we try and get something done, you know, for those kinds of situations. The cruise people, not as much.
No, unless you want to go with them.
Well, I haven't offered that yet.
Depending on where they're going, right?
I'll have to offer that next time. Take me with you and we'll work something out.
All righty. Powers of attorney. What's a power of attorney?
So a power of attorney is a legal document where you give someone else the right to make legal and financial decisions for you under a set of circumstances. And the most common set of circumstances are if I become incompetent, if I'm no longer able to make competent financial decisions, I want you, the person that you name, to make those legal and financial decisions for me. It's always separate from a healthcare directive. They're separate documents. They may be separate people. They deal with separate issues. There's some overlap when it comes to who pays for the medical decisions. But the power of attorney is really a legal and financial document.
Okay. I'd make a power of attorney because I supposedly have all my marbles now, and eventually I don't. But I don't know that I don't. So when does the power of attorney have power?
So it can either be an immediate power of attorney. So as soon as you sign it, you're giving someone the power to make those decisions for you. Or it can be what's called a springing power of attorney. And the springing power of attorney says when you become incompetent. And so the big question is, who decides you're incompetent? And I could say when my wife says I'm incompetent, then my wife becomes my power of attorney. And obviously the problem there is every time I come back from Best Buy, my wife does not believe I'm making competent financial decisions. So,
but you are, especially if it's a big screen TV.
Well, I know you would agree with me, Bob, which is maybe I should make you the person who decides. But so for most people, they're going to go with an impartial person. They're going to say when two doctors say I'm no longer able to make competent financial decisions, then my wife becomes my power of attorney. And you can mix and match. You can have it say, my wife is my immediate power. As soon as I sign this document, my wife has the power to do anything that the document says. But if something happens to her, the backup person, you know, if she gets in a car accident, who is her backup might be my kids, and I don't want them having immediate power. They have to wait till I'm incompetent. So you can mix and match that trigger as well.
Boy, have you ever seen a succession of people? I could see that.
You know, I've had people, and as I said, it's just ink on a page to me. So if you want to give me 10 names, I'll put down 10 names. Most people have trouble coming up with the second one, much less a third or a fourth or a fifth one. Because again, you're looking for that person you trust with common sense, and that's often hard to find.
Okay. So power of attorney, I mean, excuse the play on words, but it sounds very powerful. Power of attorney.
It is, and it's more powerful than people think. A broad power of attorney can change your estate planning. It can make decisions that can, you know, impact you for the rest of your life. And so you also want to think about checks and balances. You want to think about transparency, especially when you're dealing with adult children. You want Mary to be your power of attorney, your daughter Mary, because she's really efficient. She's effective. She'll get stuff done. But you want everyone to know how much money there is. You want everyone to know how the money's being used by Mary, so that while she has unilateral control, everyone knows if money's going in her pocket. And they know, more importantly, that it's not going in her pocket.
Can you have co-power of attorneys?
You can. You can either have a joint power of attorney, so it's joint. Two people who have to agree on everything. Or you can have something called joint and several powers of attorney, where essentially they can do almost anything without the other one's consent. So you can either have people and they have to agree, or you have people where one of them can go left and the other one can go right. They could make a decision that's 180 degrees opposed from each other, and both those decisions would be valid. So you really, again, the problem with programs is they don't necessarily ask you about the relationship between your son and daughter. How do they get along? What's their work style? Are they likely to have more problems if they have power together, or more problems if he has power and she doesn't? And so thinking about not just how do we get power to people, but also what happens next? What happens in their relationship?
Could I ask you a two-pronged question? I come to see you after finally, let's say that I am married, which I am, and I can convince Nancy to come see you. Or I'm not married, and I finally say, you know, I just got to go see this guy. But I can't make a decision, or we can't make a decision on who would the guardian be. Is there such a thing called a standby guardian or a temporary guardian until certain periods of time evolve?
So normally when we're talking about a standby guardian or a temporary guardianship, it's really about what happens if I'm disabled and I can't take care of my kids myself. So not so much what happens when I die, but what happens at 6 o'clock, I'm in a car accident. Who's in charge of my kids at 7? Who's in charge of my kids overnight? Who's in charge of my kids the next day? And making sure that there's a process in place, because you know what? My guardian, the people I may want to be in charge, could live in Washington State. Well, if I'm in a car accident at 6, they're no good to me at 7. They're no good to me at 8. They're not going to be able to come and take over. And so naming a person to make those decisions while you're alive but incompetent for minor kids is important. In the will itself, we very often will name a person and say, you know what, we're going to come back to this. We will do everything, we'll sign it, but if 5 months from now we have to change it, it's all on the computer. Changing one name 5 months later is easy to do. And so getting something down, again, don't let perfect get in the way of better. Getting something down that's better than the alternative is always a good idea, even if you're sure in your head that 5 months from now you're going to change it.
Okay, great. John?
Oh, is it time already to go?
No, it's not time to go. But, you know, on the federal benefit side, are there things here that we talked about that somebody should be more aware of than not, besides maybe the thrift, I guess, vaguely?
Well, the life insurance, federal life insurance, but the same considerations would apply to any life insurance, is make sure your beneficiaries are up to date and watch your life events, because that may trigger a needed change in beneficiary. That's
life events could include a new marriage or a new divorce.
Such and such. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't assume that the documents are just going to follow your life. You have to update them, and there's no open season for changing beneficiary designations. You can do them as often as you like, and make sure that they are consistent with what you want. What I tell clients all the time is, if you're not sure who your beneficiaries are, change them. Redo it, do it again, so that you know for sure.
Right, and I recently did that because I wasn't sure what our TSP, if they included our second child. So we just did a new one, sent it in.
Okay, Mark, final words. We have less than a minute.
Do the planning. If you have kids, if you're expecting kids, if you haven't done it because you're scared and you just don't want to deal with it, you got to get over it and do it. This is something that is a responsibility once you have kids.
Okay. And for those of you listening, remember, this is archived on our website, nitpinc.com, left-hand side, for your benefit radio show, 24/7. Thanks for listening. Sorry to rush, but we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.